strong, long-fingered hand caught my shoulder and steadied me. I looked up to see Justin regarding me, his dark eyes flickering with warmth that wasn't wholly the reflection of the small but growing fire in the hearth. "Flickum bickus?" he asked. I nodded and felt myself blushing again. "You know, 'cause the mediocrity." He tilted his head back and let out a rolling laugh. He ruffled my hair with one hand and said, "Well done, Harry, well done." My chest swelled up so much I thought I was going to bounce off the ceiling. Justin held up a finger, went to his desk, and returned with a brown paper package. He offered it to me. "What's this?" I asked. "Yours," he said. "You've done the work, after all." I blinked and then tore the package open. Inside was a Wilson baseball mitt. I stared for several seconds. No one had ever given me a present before. Not one that was meant for me. And not just some random charity-donated Christmas package with a label that said, "For Boy." And it was an excellent glove. George Brett had one just like it. I'd been to two Kansas City Royals baseball games on field trips when I was little, and they were awesome. So was Brett.
"Thank you," I said quietly.
Oh, come on, now I was going to cry? Sometimes I thought I was kind of goofy. Justin produced a baseball, a brand new one, that was still all white, and held it up, smiling. "If you're up for it, we can go outside right now." I felt really tired and hungry, but I had a brand new glove. I shoved my hand into it until I figured out where all my fingers were supposed to go. "Yes," I said, pushing myself up. "Let's do it." Justin bounced the ball up and down in his hand a couple of times and grinned at me. "Good. When all is done, I think you'll find baseball a rewarding experience." I followed him outside. It didn't matter that I was tired. I was practically floating. I opened my eyes, standing on a random Chicago sidewalk, immaterial and unseen. I turned my right hand palm up and focused upon that sudden kindling of light and hope, crystallized by the memory of that moment of triumph and joy. "Flickum bickus," I whispered. The fire was every bit as beautiful as I remembered. Chapter 21. It took me a couple of hours to work out how to make my trusty tracking spell function. I easily found several memories that I could use to power the spell. It was figuring out how to create the link to Molly that was hard. Usually, I would use one of the trusty traditional methods for directing thaumaturgy. A lock of hair, a fresh drop of blood, fingernail clippings, etc. That wasn't going to work, obviously. I couldn't touch them, even if I had them. So instead of tracking Molly with physical links, I tried using memories of her in their place. It worked, sort of. The first tracking spell led me to the hotel that had once hosted a horror convention known as SplatterCon. It was closed now and deserted. I guess maybe all the deaths at SplatterCon had taken a toll on the hotel in the civil court cases that followed the phobophage attacks. I took a quick spin through the place, hardly even flinching before I stomped through one wall after another. Except for a few transients who had broken into the building and were squatting there, I found nothing. I went back over my work. The memory I'd used was one that had stuck in my head for some reason, of Molly here in this building. That must have thrown off the spell. It had homed in on this place because it had been part of the memory I used to create the link. I tried again, this time omitting the background and picturing only Molly against an empty field of black. This second attempt took me to a police station from which I had once posted bail for Molly's boyfriend. I figured I'd bungled the spell somehow, but took a quick look around anyway, just in case. No Molly. "Okay, smart guy," I said to myself. "So, what if the memory image you're using is too old? You're tracking her memory self to a memory location, Which means you have to think of her as she is now to find where she is now, right? Theoretically, I said to myself. Right, so test the theory. Well, obviously. Although discussing a problem with yourself is almost never a good way to secure a divergent viewpoint. In fact, talking to yourself is often considered a sign of impending insanity, I noted aloud, which hardly seemed encouraging. I shook off the unsettling thought and worked the tracking spell again. This time, instead of using one of my earlier memories of Molly, I used my most recent one. I pictured her in her cast-off clothing and rags, as she'd been at Murphy's place. Forming a memory into an image that would support the energy required for a spell isn't as simple as closing your eyes and daydreaming. You have to produce it in exact, even fanatical detail, until it is as real in your mind as any actual object. It takes a lot of practice and energy to do that, and it is why people use props when they set out to do magic. A prop can be used as an anchor, saving a spellcaster the effort of creating not just one, but multiple mental constructs, and supporting them all in the state of perfect focus and concentration. I had learned how to do magic the hard way, first, all of it in my head. Only after I'd proved I could do it without the aid of props did Justin tell me that it was even possible to use them. Over the years, I'd practiced fairly complex thaumaturgic spells without props, maybe once a season, keeping my concentration and imagination sharp. It was a damn good thing I had. Working magic as a ghost was all about doing it au naturel. I reached into my memory to produce the construct I'd need to stand in for Molly in the tracking spell. At the time, I'd been handed a lot to process, and I hadn't really taken stock of exactly what kind of shape Molly was in. I'd seen that she was under strain, but upon closely reviewing the memory, I was somewhat shocked at how gaunt and weary she looked. Molly had always been the sort of young person who almost glowed with good health. After 6 months on her own, she looked like an escapee from a gulag, scrawny, tough, and beaten down, if not broken. I added more than that to the image. I imagined her cheery goodwill, the self-loathing she still sometimes felt for the pain she'd caused her friends in the days before I agreed to teach her. I thought of her precise, orderly approach to her studies, so much different from my own, her diligence, and the occasional arrogance that pretty much every young wizard has until they've walked into enough walls to know better. I thought of the most powerful force in her life, a deep and abiding love for her family, and added in the desolation she must be feeling to be separated from them. Eager, beautiful, dangerous Molly. I held that image of my apprentice in mind, drew together my will, and tapped into the recollection of one of my more memorable tracking spells, all at the same time. I established the pattern of the modified version of the spell I'd had to cobble together, walked, chewed bubblegum, and released the spell with a murmured word. The power surged out through me, and a precise, powerful force spun me into a pirouette. I extended my left arm, index finger, pointing, and felt a sharp tug against it each time it passed an easterly point of the compass. Within a couple of seconds, I stopped spinning, rotated a little past the point, and then settled back slightly in the opposite direction. My index finger pointed straight at the heart of the city. "Crombie," I said, "eat your heart out." I followed the spell to Molly. I pulled my vanishing act and went zipping downtown a few hundred yards at a time. I paused to check the spell twice more and correct my course, though by the third check I was starting to feel like a human weather vane. I had to stop more frequently as I got closer to make sure I was moving in the right direction, and the trail took me down into the great towers within the loop, where the buildings rose high enough to form what felt like the walls of a deep ravine, a man-made canyon of glass, steel, and stone. I wasn't terribly surprised when the spell led me to the lower streets. Some of the streets downtown have two or even three levels. One is up on the surface, with the others stacked below it. A lot of the buildings have upper and lower entrances and parking as well, doubling the amount of access to the buildings within those blocks. There were also plenty of empty spaces, pseudo-alleyways, walkways, and crawl spaces. Here and there, abandoned chambers in the basements and sub-basements of the buildings above sat in silent darkness, waiting to be remade into something new. The commuter tunnels could connect down there, and there were several entrances to the insane, deadly labyrinth beneath the city known as Undertown. Chicago cops patrolled the lower streets on a regular basis. Things came slinking out of Undertown to prowl the darkness. Traffic would blaze through on the actual streets, which were occasionally only separated from the sidewalks by a stripe of faded paint. All in all, it's not the sort of place a sane person will casually wander through. I found Molly standing in one of the narrow alleyways. Snow had fallen through a grate 20 feet overhead and covered the ground. She was dressed in the same rags I'd seen the night before, with her arms clenched around her stomach, shivering in the cold. There was a fresh, purpling bruise on her cheek. She was breathing heavily.
"Again?" said a cool, calm woman's voice from farther down the alley, out of sight.
"I'm tired," Molly said. "I haven't eaten in a day and a half."
"Poor darling. I'm sure death will understand and agree to return another time."
There was a sharp hissing sound, and Molly threw up her left hand, fingers spread. She spat out a word or two, and flickering sparkles of defensive energy spread from her fingertips into a flat plane. Molly simply didn't have a talent for defensive magic, but this was the best shield I'd ever seen a grasshopper pull off. A hurtling white sphere hit the shield. It should have bounced off, but instead it zipped through the shield, its course barely bent. The sphere struck Molly in the left shoulder and exploded into diamond glitter shards of ice. She let out a short, harsh grunt of pain and staggered.
"Focus," said the calm woman's voice. "Use the pain, make the shield real with your will. Know that it will protect you. Again."
Molly looked up with her teeth clenched, but instead of talking, she raised her left hand once more, and another ball of ice flew at her. This one hit the shield and went through, but its path was attenuated more significantly than the last. It flew past her, barely clipping one arm. She gasped and sank to one knee, panting. Magic taxes the endurance of anyone who uses it, and if you use magic you aren't particularly skilled with, you get worn down even faster. I shivered to see Molly like that. I knew how she felt. When Justin began teaching me how to create protective shields, he threw baseballs at me at top speed. When I failed, I was hit with a fastball moving at more than 80 miles an hour. Justin said pain was an excellent motivator and that the activity was good training. When I had been teaching Molly how to shield, I hadn't used anything more painful than fluffy snowballs and rotten fruit.
"That will do for now," said the woman's voice. "Tomorrow we will move up to knives."
Molly shuddered and looked down.
The speaker came walking calmly down the alley to stand over Molly.
It was my fairy godmother, the Lenanshi. Leah was beautiful, beyond the loveliness of mere humanity, but it was a stark, hungry, dangerous beauty that always reminded me of a hunting cat. She was tall and pale, her hair the color of autumn leaves at sunset. Her ears were very slightly pointed, though I wasn't sure she hadn't done that to herself in order to conform to mortal expectations. She wore a long gown of green silk, wholly unsuitable to the task of protecting a mortal from the weather. But as she was one of the most powerful she of the winter court, I doubted she even noticed the cold. She reached out a hand and touched Molly's hair with her fingertips.
"Why?" Molly asked, her voice barely more than a whisper. "Why are you doing this to me?"
"Obligation, child," Leah replied. "Favors owed and loyalties given."
"You owed it to Harry to do this to me?"
Molly asked. Nay, child, not me. But my queen is committed to him through ancient law and custom. She dispatched me to continue your training in the art, and pain is an excellent teaching tool.
Harry didn't believe that,
Molly said, her voice brittle.
He never hurt me.
The Lunanshi stooped and seized Molly's chin, jerking my apprentice's face up to meet her inhuman gaze. Then he wronged you badly, child, Leah replied, enunciating each word sharply. He cheated you of the legacy he lived and suffered to acquire. I am not teaching you how to tie knots in a rope or to bake pastries. I am making you ready to face battle and emerge alive.
I have faced battle, Molly said.
In which you were shot, of all things, by a mere mortal foot soldier, Leah said, contempt flavoring her words. You nearly died, which would have been greatly humiliating to your mentor, and by extension to my queen.
What does it matter to Mab?
Molly said, her voice bitter.
He's dead.
Leah sighed.
Mortals can be so obsessed with useless detail, it grows tiresome.
I don't understand, Molly said. Your mentor took an oath of fealty to my queen. Such oaths are not to be made lightly, and they place mutual obligations on both parties. Minor details do not excuse either party from its responsibilities.
His death is a minor detail?
As these things go, Leah said. Of course it is. You're all mortals. Even the life length of a wizard is something brief and transitory to an immortal.
Similarly, extending her hand to the assistance of those her vassal knew in life is a minor detail. If you live another 3 centuries, it is little more than a long season to the Queen of Air and Darkness.
Molly closed her eyes.
He made her promise to take care of me?
Leah blinked at her, politely baffled.
No, of course not, child. He took an oath of fealty. She is one of the she. The oath binds her as tightly as it does him, just as when I was, Leah shivered, unable to perform my duties to young Dresden. Mab assumed those responsibilities until I could be restored to them. Thus does she now do for you through me.
Molly wiped a hand over her eyes. She shook her head and rose to her feet, moving slowly.
Did he know? I mean, did he know Mab would do this?
I should have, I said quietly. If I'd stopped to think about it for 2 minutes, I should have known. But neither of them heard me.
I knew the boy well, Leah said. Better than ever he realized. Many a night did I watch over him, protecting him, and he none the wiser. But I was not privy to his mind or his heart.
Molly nodded slowly. She looked at Leah for a long moment. My godmother simply watched her, waiting until Molly nodded to herself and said,
His shade is in town, looking for the person who killed him.
The Lunanshi's pale red-gold eyebrows flew up. It was one of the most drastic reactions I had ever seen from her.
That seems unlikely,
Molly shrugged.
I used my sight. It's his ghost, all right. A construct couldn't have hidden from me.
6 months after his death? The Lunanshi murmured.
It is rare for a shade to arise after the season in which it was made, and he was slain last autumn.
Her eyes narrowed.
Interesting. She tilted her head, studying Molly. What is your condition?
Molly blinked dully once before she said,
I need to curl into a ball and sleep for a week. I'm starving. I'm cold. I think I'm getting a cold. I hurt everywhere. I would...
Molly paused and eyed Leah.
Why do you ask?
The she only smiled in answer. Footsteps sounded heavy and quick, and a small crowd appeared at the far end of the alley. They were all rough-looking men, carrying an assortment of guns, blades, clubs, and axes. They dressed exclusively in black, to the extent that it looked like they all shopped in the same store. They were also wearing turtlenecks, every single one of them. Talk about weird. Molly let out a hiss.
Servitors. How did they find me here?
I told them where to look,
Leah said calmly. Molly whirled to her.
You what?
I didn't share your location with the Fomor themselves, child, just with some of their guard dogs. They think that if they catch you and return you to the Fomor, they will gain great honor. And I did not give them enough time to contact their masters for instructions, she smiled, showing daintily pointed canines. Initiative in an underling can be such a troubling thing. Molly made a disgusted sound.
I don't believe this.
20 armed thugs kept striding forward, exuding the calm that comes only from professionals who are not hurrying, keeping their spacing smooth. They were all glaring at Molly. Leah smirked, already fading out of sight.
It is good training, child.
She vanished, Cheshire Cat style, only she left her voice behind instead of her smile.
Let us see what you have learned.
Chapter 22
What I've learned, Molly muttered, mostly under her breath. So help me, one of these days I'll show you what I've learned, you skinny bitch.
Then she focused on the enemy, took a breath, just as I'd taught her to do under stress, and calmed herself. She began to withdraw, calmly, slowly, one pace at a time. That was smart. Had she turned and sprinted, it would have provoked immediate pursuit. Instead, the guys in turtlenecks kept their professional cool, moving steadily forward in a solid block of muscles and weapons, all of them ready to kill a lone, exhausted young woman. Scum. No way in hell was that happening to my apprentice. I hadn't yet tried any true evocation magic, the fast and dirty side of violent wizardry, but I thought I had the basic concept down. So I tuned into a memory of a particularly powerful evocation, when I had blown a rampaging loop guru straight through the brick wall of one building and entirely through the building across the street. I left out all the details, except for the energy blast itself, vanished and reappeared in front of the oncoming servitors and snarled, Fuego! A blast of flame and raw kinetic force exploded from my outflung right hand. It hit the front of the enemy formation like a blazing locomotive, and washed completely through them, having no effect whatsoever. I didn't even ruffle their clothes.
Oh, come on, I shouted. That is just not fair.
I still couldn't act, couldn't touch, couldn't help. Molly faced the men alone. She kept walking back until she emerged from the alley into a small parking lot contained within concrete walls and open to the sky. There were only a handful of cars in it, along with a motorcycle and a couple of mounds of piled snow. There were doors fitted with those magnetic card swipe locks on two of the lot's walls, employee or executive parking, obviously. The fourth opening led out to the lower avenue, where dull yellow lights cast a feeble gleam. Molly walked to the middle of the little lot, looked around her, and nodded.
"Well, boys," she said aloud, "I don't suppose there's any chance we could talk about this over a cup of coffee at Denny's. I'm starving."
One of the turtlenecks, presumably their leader, said,
"Submit yourself to the will of the masters. Your pain will be much shortened."
"Right," Molly said. She rolled her neck as if to loosen it up and nodded at the speaker. "You're my huckleberry."
The turtleneck tilted his head to one side, frowning. Molly blew him a kiss. A gust of wind, channeled through the lower street, rushed by, tugging at her ragged clothes, pulling her long coattails out like a flag beside her, and then she exploded. It happened so fast that I could barely understand what was happening, much less anticipate what would come next. Where my apprentice had been standing suddenly became a half a dozen identical, leanly ragged figures darting in every direction. One Molly flew sideways, both arms extended in front of her, firing a pair of 1911 Colts
their hammering wham, wham, wham as recognizable as familiar music. Another flipped into a cartwheel and tumbled out of sight behind a parked car. Two more ran to each door, virtually mirror images of each other, swiping a card key and slamming into the buildings. A fifth Molly ducked behind a mound of snow and emerged with a shotgun, which she began emptying at the turtlenecks. The sixth ran to the motorcycle, picked it up as if it had been a plastic toy, and flung it toward her attackers. My jaw dropped open. I mean, I'd known this kid was good with illusions, but hell's bells. I might have been able to do one of the illusions Molly had just wrought. Once I had managed two under all kinds of mortal pressure. She had just thrown out six simultaneously, and at the drop of a hat to boot. My ghast was pretty well flabbered. The turtlenecks clearly didn't know how to react either. The ones with guns returned fire, and they all scattered for cover. The motorcycle didn't hit anyone as it tumbled past the group, though the crashing sound it made when it landed was so convincing that it made me doubt my such-as-they-were senses. The guns barked several times as the illusionary mollies all sought cover behind the snow mounds and cars. I gritted my teeth. You aren't one of the rubes, Dresden. You've got a backstage pass. I bent my head, touched my fingers to my forehead for a moment, and opened up my own sight. The scene changed colors wildly, going from a dull winter monochrome to an abstract done in smearing, interweaving watercolor. The blurs of magic in the air were responsible for all the tinting. Molly had unleashed a hell of a lot of energy in very little time, and she'd done so from the point of exhaustion. I'd been there enough times to know the look. Now I could see the illusions for what they were, which was the single largest reason why the wizards of the White Council didn't put much stock in illusion magic. It could be easily nullified by anyone with the sight, which was the same thing as saying anyone on the council. But against this band of hipster emo mook losers, it worked just fine. Molly, behind an almost perfect magical veil, was standing precisely where she had been at the beginning of the altercation. She hadn't moved a muscle. Her hands were extended at her sides, fingers twitching, and her face was still and expressionless, her eyes shifted out of focus. She was running a puppet show, and the illusions were her marionettes, dancing on strings of thought and will. The illusionary versions of Molly were very slightly transparent and grainy, like I remembered movies being when I was a kid. The motorcycle had never moved from where it was parked. An illusion had flown through the air, and a short-term veil was now hiding the bike. The turtlenecks, though, weren't going to be shut down by half a dozen young women, even if they had just appeared out of nowhere and apparently were possessed of weapons and superhuman strength. At barked orders from their leader, they came bounding over parked cars and mounds of snow in teams of five, moving with a light, lithe grace rarely seen outside of the Olympics and martial arts movies. They advanced with a kind of frighteningly focused purpose you see only in veterans. These men knew how to survive a battle, kill before you were killed. If even one of them closed in on Molly, it was over. I thought of what it might be like to watch my apprentice die with my sight open, and almost started gibbering. If that happened, if I saw that horror with eyes that would make sure I could never, ever forget it or distance myself from it, there wouldn't be anything left of me, except guilt and rage. I shut away my sight.
"It must be difficult," said my godmother, standing suddenly beside me, "to watch something like this without being able to affect the outcome."
"Gah!"
I said, or something close to it, jumping a few inches to one side out of sheer nerves.
"Stars and stones, Leah," I said between my gritted teeth a moment later. "You can see me?"
"But of course, Sir Knight," she replied, green eyes sparkling. "My duty to oversee my godson's spiritual growth and development would be entirely futile could I not perceive and speak to a spirit such as thee."
"You knew I was there a moment ago, didn't you?"
Her laugh was a bright, wicked sound.
"Your grasp of the obvious remains substantial, even though you do not. A curtain of green-blue fire, about 7 feet high, sprang up and swept rapidly across the width of the parking lot, between the position of the various mollies and the turtlenecks. The flames emitted eerie shrieking sounds, and the faces of hideous beings danced about inside them. I just blinked. Holy crap. I hadn't taught the kid that.
"Tsk," said Leah, watching the scene. "She has an able mind, but she is filled with the passions of youth. She rushes to her finale without building anything like the tension required for something so overt to prove effective."
I wasn't sure what my godmother was talking about, but I didn't have time to try to pry an explanation out of her. Except that I did. I mean, what else was I going to do, right? "Whatever do you mean?" I replied in a polite tone. I almost managed not to grit my teeth.
"Such an," her mouth twisted in distaste, "overt and vulgar display as that wall of fire is worthy only of frightening children or appearing in something produced by Hollywood. It might yield a short-lived panic reaction if built up and timed properly, but it is otherwise useless. And, of course, in very bad taste."
She shook her head in disapproval.
"True terror is much more subtle."
I gave my godmother a sharp look.
"What?" "Veils are of limited utility with snow upon the ground," she explained. "The footprints, you see. It's quite difficult to hide so many individual disruptions of the environment. Thus, she must work in another medium to survive."
"Stop this. You're going to get her killed," I said.
"Oh, child," the Lenanshi said, smiling. "I've been doing this for a very long time. All teaching involves an element of risk."
"Yeah," I said. "And look at what happened to your last student." Her eyes glinted.
"Yes. From nothing more than a terrified child, in a mere score of years, he grew into a weapon that all but utterly destroyed a world power. The Red Court lies in ruins because of my student, and it was, in part, my hand that shaped him."
I clenched my teeth harder. "And you want to do the same thing to Molly?"
"Potentially. She has a talent for verisimilimancy."
"Verso what?"
"Illusion, child," Leah clarified. "She has a talent, but I despair of her ever truly understanding what it is to cause terror."
"That's what she's learning from you, fear?"
"In essence."
"You aren't teaching her, Godmother. Teachers don't do that."
"What is teaching but the art of planting and nurturing power?" Leah replied. "Mortals prattle on about lonely impulses of delight and the gift of knowledge, and think that teaching is a trade like metalsmithing or healing or telling lies on television. It is not. It is the dissemination of power unto a new generation and nothing less. For her, as for you, lessons demand real risk in order to attain their true rewards."
"I won't let you turn her into a weapon, Godmother." Leah arched a red-gold eyebrow, showing her teeth again.
"You should have thought of that before dying, child. What precisely will you do to stop me?"
I closed my hands into impotent fists. The turtlenecks had been briefly stymied, but not stopped by the wall of flame. It wasn't high enough. I saw three of them moving together. Two of them linked their hands, while a third backed off, then sprinted toward the other two. The runner planted his foot on the linked hands of his supporters, and then both men lifted while the runner leapt. They flung him a good 20 feet up and over the wall of flame. The runner flipped neatly at the top of his arc and landed in a crouch, holding a machete in his right hand, a pistol in his left. He calmly put two rounds directly into the shotgun-wielding Molly, and two more into the pistol-packing version. Before the last shot rang out, a second turtleneck had gone over the wall and landed beside the first, the leader, I noted. He carried no obvious weaponry, though his belt had been hung with several seashells in a manner that suggested they were dangerous equipment. He remained in a crouch when he landed, looking around with sharp, steady eyes while his partner covered him. Shotgun Molly crumpled slowly to the ground, still fumbling at a pocket for more shells for the weapon, while scarlet blood stained the fresh layer of thin snow. Two-gun Molly's head snapped back as a dark hole appeared in her forehead, and her body dropped to the snow like a rag doll. Motorcycle-chucking Molly screamed and snatched up her fallen sister's guns. The turtleneck on lookout raised his weapon, but Captain Turtleneck moved his hand in a sharp negative gesture, and the man lowered the weapon again. Both did nothing as the newly armed Molly aimed the guns and began to fire. Puffs of snow flitted up from the ground a couple of times, but neither was hit. Captain Turtleneck nodded to himself and smiled. Crap, he'd figured it out. Coordinated squads of bad guys are one thing. Coordinated squads of bad guys being led by someone who remained observant and cool in the middle of combat chaos were far, far worse.
Ah, disbelief, Leah murmured. Once the mark begins to suspect illusion is at work, there's little point in continuing.
Stop them, I said to Leah. Godmother, please, stop this.
She turned to blink at me. And why should I?
Captain Turtleneck scanned the ground, and I saw his eyes trace the line of footsteps Molly had made when she had backed into the center of the parking lot, when the confrontation had begun. His eyes flicked around, and I could practically see the thoughts going through his head. A trail of messy, backward tracks suddenly ended in two clear boot prints. The only Molly inside had proven to be an illusion, and therefore the real Molly must be nearby, supporting the still active illusions around him. Where would she be standing? That last set of boot prints seemed a logical place to look. Captain Turtleneck drew one of the seashells from his belt, murmured something to it, and gave it an expert, effortless flick. It sailed through the air and landed only inches from my invisible apprentice's toes.
Oh, Leah said, setting her mouth into a pouting moo. Pity. She had such potential.
I gave my godmother my most furious glare and sprinted forward. The shell began to glow with a urine-colored light. It had worked for Morty. Maybe it would work again. I flung myself at Molly, focusing on protecting her, and I felt myself slide into her, merging and mingling from the soles of my feet to the crown of my head, which hardly made sense, given how much taller I was than she. One more example of the way physics doesn't necessarily apply to spirits. I suddenly felt utterly exhausted, frightened, and at the same time in a state of euphoric exaltation. I could feel the various illusions dancing upon threads of my will, demanding complete focus and concentration. My legs and feet ached, my ribs ached, my face and shoulder hurt. And then I felt myself choke, then wonder what the hell was happening to me.
It's me, kid,
I thought as loudly as I could.
Don't fight me.
I didn't know what the seashell would do, but there wasn't much time to get particular. I extended my left hand along with my will and murmured,
Defendarius.
Blue energy suddenly blazed up around Molly and me in a sparkling sphere. The seashell shone brighter and exploded into a sphere of pure white fire, as hot and fierce as a microscopic nuclear warhead. It lashed against the blue sphere like a bat hitting a baseball. The sphere went flying, taking us with it. I braced my arms and legs against the sides of the sphere, straining to hold it together. Without my shield bracelet, I wasn't sure how long I could keep it up. The sphere struck a car and bounded off it into a wall of the building. Its path had us careening, tail over tea kettle, but our braced arms and legs kept us from smashing our head against the sphere's interior. We wobbled and rolled into a corner of the lot, and I realized dully as I looked around that Molly's illusions had vanished. My bad. The strength of the shield had cut her off from them and ended her ability to keep them going. I looked up to find the turtlenecks advancing on us in a crowd, and I dismissed the sphere, landing in a crouch. I gathered more of my will together and swept my arm from left to right with a murmured word, and a second curtain of blue fire sprang up between me and the oncoming bad guys. One of them gave the wall of flame a disdainful snort and calmly walked into it. Like I said, I'm not much when it comes to illusions. I am, however, reasonably good with fire. The turtleneck didn't scream. He didn't have time. When fire is hot enough, you never really feel the heat. Your nerves get fried away, and all you feel is the lack of signal from them. You feel cold. He died in the fire, and he died cold. The cinder that fell backward out of the fire could never have been casually identified as human. Now that got their attention. I stood there holding the fire against the remaining turtlenecks, the heat scorching away the thin layer of snow on the asphalt, then making it bubble and quiver, changing it into my own personal moat of boiling hot tar. It was hard work to keep it going, but I've never been afraid of that. "Harry, I need some room," came a thought from Molly, hardly able to be heard over the blaze of concentration necessary for maintaining the fire. I gritted my teeth. It was like trying to hold an immensely heavy door open while half a dozen friends squeezed in around me. I felt an odd sensation and increased weariness and blocked them both away. I needed to focus to hold the turtlenecks away from Molly. Once again, the bad guys impressed me. They knew that an intense magical effort could be sustained for only a limited amount of time. They didn't risk losing more men to the fire. Instead, they played it smart. They just waited. The fire blazed for another minute, then two, and as my control over it began to get shaky, something attracted my attention. Flashing blue lights out on the lower avenue. A CPD prowler had stopped across the entrance to the parking lot, and a pair of cops, guys I'd seen before, got out and walked quickly into the lot, flashlights up. It took them about half a second to see that something odd was going on, and then they had both guns and flashlights up. Before the turtlenecks could turn their guns on the police, the officers had retreated to the cover offered by their car, out of direct line of sight from the parking lot. I could clearly hear one of them calling for backup, SWAT, and firefighters, his voice tense and tight with fear. I felt myself giggling with exhaustion and amusement as I grinned at Captain Turtleneck.
Bad boys," I sang off-key. "What you gonna do?"
That made Molly cough up a chittering belly laugh, which shouldered my awareness aside and came bubbling out of our mouth. Captain Turtleneck stared at me without expression for a moment. He looked at the fire, the moat, and then at the police. Then he grimaced and made a single gesture. The turtlenecks began to move as a single body, retreating rapidly back the way they had come. Once I was sure they were gone, I dropped the wall and slumped to the ground. I sat there for a second, dazzled by the discomfort and the weariness, which I had rapidly grown accustomed to missing, apparently. The smell of hot asphalt, a strangely summertime smell, mingled with the scent of charred turtleneck. I shivered. And I made a gentle effort and withdrew from the same space Molly occupied. The weariness and pain vanished again. So did the vibrant scents. The grasshopper looked up and around, sensing the change. Then she said, "Hold on, Harry," and fumbled at her pockets. She produced a small silver tuning fork, struck it once against the ground, and then said, "I can hear you with this."
"You can?"
"Yeah, no big deal," she said, her voice slurred with fatigue. "See you too, if I line it up right. And it's easier to carry around than a bunch of enchanted Vaseline." "We've got to get out of here," I said, "before the cops show up. They'd try to lock you up for a long time." Molly shook her head. "Kid, I know you're tired, but we have to move."
"No,"
she said.
"No cops."
I arched an eyebrow at her.
"What?"
"Never were any cops," Molly said. I blinked, looked at the empty entrance to the parking lot, and then found myself slowly smiling. They were another illusion, and you sold it to the turtlenecks because they thought you'd already blown your wad on the flashy stuff.
"Excellent," purred Leah, appearing at my side again.
I flinched again. Man, I hate that sudden appearance stuff.
"An unorthodox but effective improvisation, Miss Carpenter," she continued. "Adding complexity on the meta level of the deception was inspired, especially against well-informed adversaries."
"Uh-huh, I'm a rock star," Molly said, her voice listless. "Lesson over?" The Lenan she glanced at me, and then back to Molly, still smiling. Indeed. Both of them.
Chapter 23.
Which only goes to prove that you're never too old, too jaded, too wise, or too dead to be hoodwinked by one of the Fae.
You set her up, I snarled. For my benefit? As a lesson for me?
Child, Leah said. Of course not. It was entwined with her own lesson as well.
Molly smiled very slightly.
Oh, yes, I feel I have grown tremendously from my experience of nearly being incinerated.
You saw that your survival depended on the protection of another, my godmother responded, her voice sharp. Without help from my godson's spirit, you would have died.
There are a lot of people who can say something like that, Molly said. There's no shame in being one of them.
Leah looked from Molly to me and then said,
Children, so emotional and so rarely grateful. I will leave you to consider the value of what I have this evening shown unto you both.
Hold it, I said. You aren't going yet.
Leah looked at me with a flat expression. Oh?
No, you're giving Molly money first.
Why would I do such a thing?
Because she's hungry, she's tired, she survived your lesson, and she needs to eat.
Leah shrugged a shoulder. What is that to me?
I scowled. If you're her mentor, your support of her physical needs while she learns is implicit in the relationship. And since you're filling in for me anyway, and since my choice right now would be to get food into her, if you don't do it, you'll be failing in your duty.
The Lenanshi rolled her eyes and murmured with a trace of amusement. Now is when you choose to begin paying attention to proper protocol, child?
Apparently, I said. Stop being cheap. Cough up the dough.
Her green eyes narrowed dangerously. I do not care for your tone, child. I'm through being intimidated by you, I replied, and to my surprise it came out in a calm and reasonable tone rather than a defiant one. You're the one with an obligation. I'm not being unreasonable. Pay up.
The Lenanshi turned to face me fully, those feline eyes all but glowing with either anger or pleasure, or maybe both. Molly ordered the moons over my hammy and hot chocolate. I sat across the table from her at Denny's, my elbow on its surface, my chin resting on the heel of my hand. The table could support my elbow because I had decided it should. Her tuning fork sat upright on the table, humming slightly, directly between us. She'd said she could see me if I didn't move too far to the left or right. Molly tore into the food with a voracious appetite.
Weren't you the one always trying to get me to eat healthier? I mused.
Fight me, she mumbled through a mouthful of food.
Freaking ice age out there. Gotta have fats, proteins, carbs, just to get my furnace going, keep my body temperature up.
You know what else would keep it up? I asked her. Being indoors. She snorted and ignored me for several minutes, venting a ravenous appetite onto the food.
I watched her and found it oddly fulfilling. I'd been looking out for the grasshopper for a while. It made me feel good to see her hunger being satisfied because of something I had done. I guess ghosts have to take pleasure in the little victories, just like everyone else. I waited until she was cleaning up the remains to ask, So, what's with the Ophelia Act in front of Murphy and company? She froze for a second, then continued moving bits and pieces around her plate with somewhat less enthusiasm.
It isn't...
She exhaled slowly, and her eyes moved around the room restlessly.
There's more than one reason.
I'm listening, I said.
Well, who says it's an act?
She flipped a couple of bits of hash brown onto her fork and then into her mouth.
Look at me. I'm sitting here talking to my dead mentor, and half the restaurant is worried about it.
I looked around. She was getting covert stares, all right.
Yeah, but there's hardly anyone here.
She laughed a bit harshly.
That makes me feel better.
She put her cup of hot chocolate to her lips and just held it there, trails of steam curling up around her blue eyes. So, you've finally been inside me. I feel like I should be offering you a cigarette. I choked and had to clear my throat. It wasn't like that, kid.
Of course it wasn't, she said, an edge in her voice. It never was. Not for you.
I rubbed at the back of my neck.
Molly, when I met you, I was a child who didn't need a bra, she said. It's about your father, too, I said. Michael is the uncle you never had, she said, her voice still calm but crisp. You've always wanted his approval, because he's a good man, and if he approves of you, you can't be a total wreck.
I scowled at her.
I've never said that, I said.
She looked at me through wisps of steam and said, But it's true all the same.
I had that worked out by the time I was about 17.
You were afraid that if you touched me, you'd be losing his approval, that it would make you some kind of monster.
I was afraid that I'd be losing my approval of me, I responded. And not a monster, Molly, just an asshole.
When I was a child, she said, still speaking very quietly, you'd have been right. I'm in my mid-20s, Harry. I'm not a child.
Don't remind...
I paused, then I said, I was going to make an old-age joke. I looked down at my immaterial self. But all things considered... She let out enough of a snort to stir the steam. She took a slow drink of hot chocolate.
Little inappropriate, even if you were still alive.
But funnier, I said. You're not the one who is going to watch her entire family grow old and die, Harry, she said it without malice. Not just my parents, my brothers and sisters, all of them. I'm going to be beginning to get respect from other wizards about the same time Hope and little Harry are dying of old age.
Maybe you'll get lucky and someone will kill you first. She shrugged.
Leah's been doing what she could about that. If it happens, it happens. As long as there's a reason for it, that kind of death wouldn't bother me. I shivered, just from the emotionless tone of her voice.
Except for the dead part?
Everyone dies, Harry, she said. There's no use whining about it. I waited for a couple of beats and then said, Here's where you talk about how what you do with your life is what's truly important. Her head fell back and she let out a belly laugh. It sounded warm and natural. Her eyes were just too wide, though, her smile too strained.
Yeah, exactly.
She shook her head and looked at me intently.
Is that what it's always like for you? Throwing fire that way?
I blinked and tried to change mental gears. I didn't do it as smoothly as she had. Someone uncharitable or unbiased might note that it could be because Molly had stripped said gears.
Back at the fight with the Fomor guys.
They weren't the Fomor, Molly corrected me. They were humans the Fomor have altered. They're called turtlenecks, I said. She arched an eyebrow.
You and Murphy both.
No, they're known as servitors. The Fomor muck around with them. Install things, gills, extra muscles, organs for sonar, night vision eyes. I whistled. All kinds of fun. She nodded. The odd bits kind of turn to jelly when they die. Police are calling them transients. I nodded and tried to keep the conversation casual. A lot of them dying around here?
It's Chicago, she said. There's always someone dying around here. And you should see what these animals do, Harry. They take people right out of their beds, grab children waiting for the school bus. They've tortured people to death for fun.
As she spoke, the calm in her voice had begun to fracture. It wasn't dramatic, just a break of her voice, an inhalation between sentences that was a little too harsh.
You can't stand around doing nothing, I said, nodding.
No, she said. They'll come and scream at you in your sleep if you try, so.
So?
Molly was silent. I didn't push. 5 minutes went by before she closed her eyes and whispered,
It's easy. It shouldn't be so easy.
Technically, I didn't have a heart anymore. It couldn't twist. It couldn't break. It did, anyway.
The first one was paying off a cop. Gold coins. He stood there with a little girl in a gym bag and paid the cop to look the other way. She swallowed. God, if I could be like you. Have so much power to pour out, like water from a hydrant. But I've just got a squirt gun. Not even a super soaker. Just one of the little ones.
She opened her eyes and met mine.
But it was enough. They didn't even know I was there. Molly, I said gently, what did you do? An illusion. A simple one. I made the bag of gold look like a gun. The cop drew his weapon and shot him. But the servitor lived long enough to break the cop's neck. She held up a pair of fingers. Twofer. For one little illusion. I swallowed. I couldn't speak. Her voice slowly gained volume.
There have been others like that. I mean, God, they make it simple. You just need an opportunity and the right little nudge at the right time. Green traffic light instead of a red one. Put a knife in someone's hand. Or a wedding ring on one finger. Add a spot of blood to someone's collar. They're animals. They tear into one another like animals. Molly, I said gently.
I started leaving the bits of rag on them, she said. It hurt at first, being near that kind of experience. It still hurts. But I have to do it. You don't know, Harry, what you did for this town.
What do you mean?
You don't know how many things just didn't come here before because they were afraid.
Afraid of what?
She looked at me as if her heart was breaking.
Of you, Harry. You could find anything in this town, but you never even noticed the shadow you cast.
Her eyes overflowed and she slashed at them angrily with one hand.
Every time you defied someone, every time you came out on top against things you couldn't possibly have beaten, your name grew. And they feared that name. There were other cities to prey on, cities that didn't have the mad wizard Dresden defending them. They feared you.
I finally understood.
The rag lady. Sometimes me, Molly said. Sometimes it's Leah. She's like a kid on recess when she takes a shift. I'm building a new name, creating something else for them to fear. I can't do what you did, Harry.
Her eyes, red and blue, flashed with something dangerous, deadly, and she slammed the heel of her hand onto the table as she leaned toward me.
But I can do that. I can kill them. I can make the fuckers afraid.
She stared at me, her breathing heavy. It took her several seconds to look slowly around the room. Every eye in the place was locked on Molly. A waitress stood with wide eyes and a telephone against her ear. Molly looked around at them for a moment and then said,
God, you people have it good. You don't know. You wouldn't know if one of them walked up to you and tore the thoughts out of your skull.
She rose, grabbed the tuning fork, and left a pile of wadded bills on the table. She pointed at the waitress and said,
Put the phone down, or you won't get a tip.
The telephone dropped from the woman's fingers and clattered on the floor.
See, she said, glancing back in my general direction. It's what I do. It's what I'm good for.
I sat there, stunned and heartbroken, unable to think of anything to say or do to help Molly. I watched my mad apprentice stalk out of the silent restaurant and into the frozen night. Chapter 24. I walked the shadowy streets, thinking, or at least trying to think. When I'd been alive, walking was something I did when I needed to chew something over. Engage the body in effort and activity, and the purely physical manifestations of a mental problem stopped being distractions. I didn't have a body anymore, but I didn't know how else to cope with so many overwhelming troubles. So I walked, silent and invisible, my head down, and I thought furiously as I went. A single fact glared out at me, blazing in front of my mind's eye in stark reality, illuminated by all the lives that were on fire around me. In the end, when it had mattered most, I'd blown it.